Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
What up, Lou? What's good, bro?
What's up, brother? How you feel?
Good, man. Good, man.
Cool, man.
It's cool, huh, Fonte? And he got a haircut for this? Oh, nice. Nice.
You know what I mean?
Nice.
I had to shape it up. Outside. Yeah. In my homie garage.
Oh, outside. Okay.
Hell yeah. Outside, masked up in the garage. That's how we do it.
I ain't seen you with a haircut so long. I'm like, who is that? What his name is?
You know what I'm saying? Dangerous man with some money in my pocket.
Ooh, and a beard. Ooh, that's funny. That's funny.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Questlove Supreme. I'm your host, Questlove. We have Team Supreme today. In the house, we have Laia. Where are you right now, Laia?
I am in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles.
At home, yep, show is.
With a giant Talib Kweli poster behind me. Oh, no, that's Common. I'm sorry.
It's both of them. It's that long time ago when they went on tour, when Common was wearing a knit hat.
Yeah. I see. Eons ago. Shook and Steve in the house. We're in the same place, but we're in separate rooms. What's up, Steve?
I like it this way. You know, close by, but not too close.
Okay. Fontigolo, fresh cut.
What up?
Tigolo?
Yeah, man. Had to bring in the spring the right way, so... Went and got cut up in my homeboy garage today.
This is your first cut in a year or so, or?
Nah, I've been cut a few times, but it's only been over the year. I probably only got cut like 2-3 times. So it ain't been, and every time I got cut, it was the same situation. We was cutting outside. So this is my first one in months. Since it's my first one of the year, for sure.
Oh, okay. Cool. All right. Well, good to see you getting fresh for 2021. What can I say, y'all? It's an honor and a pleasure to have our guest on the show today. Amongst his achievements, being one of the founding members of one of the most crucial production teams in hip-hop culture and music, but dare I say, one of the first major production teams in hip-hop culture, like previous to Full Force's arrival on the scene, I'll say that most music production was usually a one-man show or kind of a duo at best, but it should be noted that in addition to a vast array of the artists that they work with, like UTFO, Britney Spears, Lisa Cult Jam, NSYNC, Selena, Backstreet Boys, James Brown, my favorite R&B name of all time next to Lilo Thomas, which is Cheryl Pepsi Riley.
Yes!
I always have to say her name with the zest of a gospel play announcer, you know, like Richard Dimples Fields, Ricky Bell, right. Shannon, and Cheryl Pepsi Riley. Wait a minute, I'm joking right now, but I believe
heard.
Yeah, wasn't there a Thanks for My Child gospel play? I believe there was one.
Really?
I know she was in gospel plays. I don't know if it was a Thanks for My Child one.
I believe I once heard. It's one of those things for my child moments in a gospel play. It's like way before Tyler Perry. Anyway, I digress. Some of the greatest jams ever, name them. Roxanne, I Wonder If I Take You Home, Can You Feel the Beat, Static, yes. Try Me, or as Jasmine Guy pronounced it, Try Me.
Try Me.
Try Me. Try
Me.
Head to Toe, All Cried Out, way more hits, more than if I name them all, we'll be here all night. And despite his and his team's penchant for playing some of the scariest villains on the silver screen, Crush Groove and Harlem Party, yeah, I will say that they're probably some of the nicest guys ever. And I personally want to add that, you know, growing up, being 14 years old, stuck with a very dweeby, nerdy voice disposition, our guest today was a personal hero of mine because you just didn't see this level of nerdiness and funkiness and authenticness coming from the same source. So yeah. I'll say that he doesn't get enough praise for his contributions, and I'm speaking for the entire Four Squad. They made an immediate impression on me because there was definitely a moment when I was like 15 trying to decide in the crack era of West Philadelphia, should I code switch my way into adulthood or just be my nerdy self? And I chose the latter wisely. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Questlove Supreme, my personal hero, Bow-Legged Lou of Full Force.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, man.
What's up? What's up? What's up, you guys?
Lou, I don't know if you remember, Lou. We actually met. This is a couple years ago. The Harris family in Raleigh, North Carolina. They did Teen Fest, and you and your brothers came over to the crib, and we met there. That was like our first time meeting. But I mean, this was probably like 2015 or something. It's some years back. But they're just a great family, and they said, "Yeah, you know, the Full Force guys are coming over," and I was like, "Really?
Wow!"
And then y'all showed up. I was like, "Oh shit, that's really them."
All six of them.
It was Lou, it was Paul Anthony, and then B-Fine. I think it was just three of y'all that night, because y'all were doing something for Teen Fest. And I even called Knife that night. I was like, "Bro, you ain't gonna believe this shit. You gotta come over here." And he was like, "I said, "Bro, you just gotta come over here." And he came over, and like that whole night, me and him were just texting each other back and forth, like lines from House Party and shit. Like, it was the funniest shit. But now y'all was good dudes, man. It was good to meet y'all brothers, man. It's big
inspiration. Thanks, brother, man. I'm glad you shouted out the Harris family, because it was Donna Maria.
Donna Maria
Harris. And Glenn. Her husband, or ex-husband, I think now. Was it Lenny? Lennis?
Glennis. I think they still married. Well, as far as I know, they still married. But
okay. But anyway, still beautiful people regardless, whether together or apart.
Wait, we always got to ask if couples have made it past past the pandemic. You know, I've taken count. There's at least 18 of my friends that have kicked the bucket. Didn't make it.
Wow.
Lou, I know your brothers are B-Fine and Paul Anthony, but what's your relationship with Shy Kurt and Baby Jerry? Like, are they cousins or they're just friends?
No, they are blood cousins. So it's a family affair. They are three cousins, and we have family affair.
Okay. So it's kind of like the Isley Brothers situation, which is three main brothers and then adding family members and supplementing the group. Yes. Yo, man, this is it. What's weird is that you and I became friends on social media, and I always wanted to interview you, which is kind of why I always kept a distance, because I wanted to save our first conversation for the show.
Oh, shit.
So if anything, I made Jimmy Jam his proxy, because I've already interviewed Jimmy Jam. So like now Jam and I like talk every day. But this is like the moment I've been waiting for the show, like to use this as that moment. Where are you right now as we speak?
I'm actually upstairs in my office.
But I mean, I don't know what city you reside in now.
Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, the Poconos. That's where I live.
Wow.
Oh, okay.
You're PA?
Yes. Me and my brothers, we've been up here for like at least 15 years. And
what?
You know, the three of us, we just made a brother move from Brooklyn to here. You know? and I never really wanted to move here. Okay. But what made me come here is that Paul, all of a sudden, when he was going through his cancer journey, he just wanted to move. He just wanted, let's get out of Brooklyn. Let's just go. So I was my brother's keeper during all his cancer journey. So I'm like, okay. He said to me, listen, this is what we're going to do. I already spoke to B, you know, B-Fine. I spoke to B, and we said, let's all move together. And we just build some houses from ground up. We go to the Poconos. We don't want mom to live by herself anymore. So she'll live with you. And because you're not married anymore, you know, me and B still married. So that's what we're going to do. And that's what we're going to do. And I'm like, and that was it. I mean, I'm like, damn, who made that decision? It wasn't me, but I was my brother's keeper. And I'm here now. So it's all good.
So how's it like with moms, man? Having your moms in the house, how's that like?
Well, my mom's, I became her primary caretaker last March when COVID started. So she lives with me, and it's all good. You know, I'm just taking care of her the best way I can, and my brothers will chip in and pitch in. And she's got health issues, but we're here for her just like she was for us when we were growing up. So it's all good.
I can dig it.
So have you guys always made decisions with each other like nomads? Because this is definitely like a nomad move where no matter what happens, we all move together, which is weird because once I became adult, the first thing I did was got as far away as possible from my family.
You know, so funny is that Paul lives that we live in the same cul-de-sac. He's like directly across from me. He wanted to be that close to our mom. So we're directly, he could open his door. Hey, Lou, you all right? And he'd say like all the time, back and forth. My brother B, he lives like, I would say 10 minutes from us. And he's like, listen, I don't mind living close to y'all, but I just don't want to live too close. That was him, you know. But Paul's directly across from me, like directly across with our houses. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask, like, what made the Poconos? Because y'all are from Brooklyn, so you could have did Jersey, you skipped Philly, you could everything. Why just the Poconos?
I mean, you gotta ask Paul. I mean, him and B, they wanted to do that, and that's what we did. So okay. It's all good.
You know,
I didn't really want to come out here, but it's just fine. It's cool. But my nightlife was always New York City, you know, and it'll stay my nightlife, especially when COVID finishes up. But I was going back and forth anyway, because we still have a little crash pad office in Brooklyn. But yeah.
Gotcha.
Well, I'm from Philly, so, you know, I used to go to the Poconos a lot. Are you guys near Stroudsburg, or is there another part of?
Yeah, we're close by Stroudsburg.
I got to ask you, are those like resorts still open, like Cove Haven and Paradise Stream and
all of
like
that.
All those like Dirty Dancing. Newlywed?
Still. Yes, still.
Yeah. The kind of circuit that my dad did was always like, you know, you would do you do the Catskills and then you do 2 months in the Catskills and then we do like 3 months in the Poconos. And back then I was like too young because these were like newlywed resorts. So you weren't allowed to, kids weren't allowed on the property.
Wow. Oh, okay.
So, you know, that's where I did a majority of my MTV watching because I just had to stay in the house and watch MTV 9 hours while they were at work because kids weren't allowed to just walk around. So, yeah, I kind of missed it there. So what part of Brooklyn were you guys from initially?
Well, it began with me and my two brothers. Like, we grew up as very young kids, and that's when we started, you know, singing, thanks to my father's the one that groomed us for that. And we started out in Bedford-Stuyvesant first. We lived on 670 Halsey Street between Patchen and Reed. Then we moved to Kingston Avenue, which was Crown Heights, Kingston Avenue between Bergen and Dean. And then we moved to East Flatbush, Lenox Road between Schenectady and East 46. So when we got to East Flatbush is when, you know, we became full force with our cousins because they was already living there.
And what was the environment like in Brooklyn at the time when you were growing up?
Well, in Bed-Stuy, I would have to say, in Bed-Stuy, I mean, it was cool. You would never know. It was kind of crazy because we were in public school then. But I think when we went to Crown Heights in Brooklyn, man, it was just some good times. We'd be on the street corners playing Skelly right on the damn ground. Like every day we play Steal the Bacon. We play Booties Up. We would always go to Kingston
Say
Park.
What?
I thought you know.
Booties Up is like you chase people around the whole damn block. And then when you capture them, you line them up against the wall. And it's almost like a firing squad. But instead of a firing squad, they all with their butts out, wearing clothes, of course, and we would take these Pensy Pinker balls, like how you play handball with it.
Ass
and
ball.
We'd throw it at them. And we kill. Man, we used to make some sore asses, and it was crazy. We were reckless, and they were hurting people and making people bleed. That's what we played.
We would take it to the next level in West Philly and use softballs.
Oh, man. Geez.
Yo, man. Ah, ass ball. Yeah, I remember that. Yikes.
Oh, man.
I got to ask, because the thing is that I know, like, nothing irks me more when people make a big deal of, like, you speak so well, because they're basically trying to say that the exterior from which the voice is coming out of does not match the voice, which, I mean, I grew up with that shit all my life. Like, I was always a big dude. you know, kind of scary looking or whatever. And then I start talking and they're like, they're totally disarmed. And, but was it always that way for you when you were growing up in Brooklyn?
I mean, not really, but you know, I think, cause I remember you broached that same, see, I remember everything. When we connected on social media, I think it was, what was it, MySpace, I'm thinking?
You maybe it was Friendster.
Yeah, yeah. or Etch-A-Sketch. But you,
right.
You exactly mentioned that to me. You said, yeah, man, I remember when you guys did Soul Train.
Yeah.
And Don Cornelius must have said twice in that interview, well, you guys are very articulate. And we really like you, and you're very articulate. And, you know, because the way we looked, you know, we came off with Jerry Curls. We were definitely the first R&B group to show physical fitness physique with our Jerry Curls.
So that's lightly putting it that way.
We were the very first ones to do it. So that's why people just made a lot of jokes. So people just thought differently. But when we started talking and flowing, you know, people get caught off guard, you know. I don't know why, but that's just how it is. You know, people think something else. You know what? I'll never forget when we were getting ready, when we was on the set of House Party 2. And Ralph Tresvant, who was performing in House Party 2, mm-hmm. he did a number.
Yo, Baby Yo joint.
Yeah. Right, right, exactly. He said to us, he said, man, let me tell you something, man. When I first heard that y'all were going to be in House Party, I kept saying to myself, well, what the hell are they gonna do? How are they gonna say their lines? Are they gonna say, look at Spot Run, look at John Joe, look at, I'll never forget when he told me that. I was like, you're crazy, man. He said, no, that's what I thought, man. It's hilarious.
Nah, dude, because I was gonna say the reason before I got my current management now, there was like one dude in Philadelphia that might have been in some street activity in Philadelphia, and he wanted to like invest money in the Roots and like, you know, give us like a couple, like 20,000 to do a demo or something like that. But I kept thinking about you guys in Crush Groove and was like, nope, nah, nada. Well, okay, I always ask, what do you remember the first album or first record you ever purchased?
The first album I ever purchased was The Temptations' Greatest Hits. And that's when they were still on Motown, and it was only like 10 songs on there. They didn't have their picture on the cover. It was just The Temptations. And
oh, that silver cover?
Listing their greatest hits, like The Way You Do the Things You Do. All their early stuff, because I've been a Temptations nerd since I was in public school, always loving the Temptations. My brother Paul would always make fun and go, oh, you really like the Temptations? All 25 of them? Okay. Well, that was my group back then, and still their legacy is still my all-time favorite. And I got every Temptation album you can mention. You know, I love the Temptations, the whole style.
What, Bareback too?
I got Bareback also.
Riding Bareback.
First time I heard this song, I lost my mind. I was like, what the fuck? Riding Bareback?
I got their winners and I got their losers. I got them all.
Wait, no. This is, I wasn't too discerning as a kid when records came in the house, but I definitely knew my dad's face when he brought home the House Party album that came out, I think, after A Song for You. I think that was 76. And I remember, again, like I was 5 years old, so I didn't know what critically acclaimed was or a good record or bad record. But I definitely remember my dad being not too happy with that particular Temptations record. And so, wow.
House Party. I remember that one too, man. They did a House Party album before the damn movie.
Exactly. Exactly. Wait, what's the order of you and your brothers? Who's the oldest and middle and youngest?
I'm the oldest. Paul Anthony is the middle, and my brother B-Fine is the youngest out of the three of us.
And aren't y'all a first generation? Like, aren't your parents from the islands?
Well, yeah, Rikers.
Oh, I don't know why I thought. That's funny.
Where's your... Oh, my dumb ass fell for that shit. Like,
She was like, oh, wow, damn. No.
I know Rikers right from the jump.
Mm-hmm. My father's from St. Thomas, Virgin Islands.
Okay, I ain't crazy.
And my mother's from Santo Domingo. And I was born, I was also born at St. Thomas, Virgin Islands. I was like 3 years old when I came up to New York, you know. Paul was made in St. Thomas, but born in New York.
Ah, okay.
Wait, in Santo Domingo, is that Dominican Republic?
That's the Dominican Republic for my mother, yeah. Yeah, yes, indeed.
So what is that music?
Summer of 1980, I lived in the Frenchman's Reef.
Wow.
What's that? Yeah,
my parents did a my parents would do like 3 to 6 months residency at a resort. So,
oh, okay.
The Frenchman's Reef. So, like the Contiki, and they would just go between St. John's, St. Thomas, and St. Croix, I believe. Like,
St. Croix.
But mm-hmm. we lived in the Frenchman's Reef in there. And all I remember was that's the first time I saw like old black men playing dominoes just on the street corner.
Yeah, man. Dominoes is the game for the islands, man.
But they would break the table like
domino, nigga.
Right, exactly. Like that level of that.
Or brother, domino brother.
No.
Nah, you had it right the first time.
Yeah, exactly. You had it correct the first time. So growing up in Brooklyn, like, what was just the musical environment? Like, what were the first shows you went to? And how did that affect you and your brothers as entertainers?
Man, well, what happens is that as we were growing up, me and my brothers starting out, and we were so young when my father was assembling us to sing. Like, I think Paul had to be 8 years old, third grade, and I was 9. And then my brother B-Fine was 5. But Paul was the first one that started singing. And this was in when we was in Bed-Stuy. And Paul was the first one to sing. He was singing in the bathroom because we didn't have a shower, but we had a bathroom. And he was singing in the bathroom. And he was singing this song by Smokey Robinson called If You Can Want. And Paul would sing that song. And my father was like, oh, shit, honey. And he would tell my mother, he got a voice. And my father, he was one of those doo-wop singers. He would be on the street corners with his friends, and they would do the doo-wop harmony. They had groups called the Criterions. He used to even work with Frankie Lyman one time. But that was his
thing.
Wait,
your father was in the Criterions?
Yeah, the Criterions, yeah. Wow. He was in that group.
I might know that. I'm a doo-wop kid myself, so
yeah,
I know that name. Wow.
And they used to do harmonies at the house and everything. He's the one that taught us about how to sing harmony. And it would be me and Paul, because I got interested because he was working with my brother. So I got a little jealous and he started working with me. My brother B-Fine wasn't really interested in singing, but my father forced him. And he said, and he would give him a spanking. If you don't sing, you do nothing else. He had no choice. B had no choice but to sing. And
I was waiting for the Joe Jackson story. All right.
Yeah, that's something. It could have been like that, but he wasn't that mean. But once we started singing, then my Uncle Cito formed us as a group. He bought us these frilled shirts and he made us a group. And we went by the name of the Amplifiers when we were growing up in Brooklyn. And we started out so young, but we would be singing the songs from the records, you know, Ball of Confusion, 25 Miles by Edwin Starr, one of my favorite joints. Oh, and we would just be doing that as we're growing up. And then what happened is that they took us to the Apollo Theater. Because back in the day, before Showtime at the Apollo, of course, the Apollo used to have like shows every week. They would have like 10 shows every week, you know, 2 or 3 shows a day. And they had a amateur night every Wednesday, way before Showtime at the Apollo. But every Wednesday, you had to win first prize 4 weeks in a row. And if you do that, you get to appear on the professional show. Well, we went on there and we did the song called Cloud Nine, which was by the Temptations. Mm-hmm. And we killed it like every week. And we won first place at the Apollo Theater every week. And then we appeared on the professional show with the late, great Joe Tex and the Whispers, which was the Whispers' first time at the Apollo Theater back then. They had a song called Seems Like I Gotta Do Wrong. And I'm telling you, before that, my uncle, my aunt, my father would take us to the Apollo Theater, like religiously. We saw all these shows growing up, youngsters, you know, Joe Simon, you know, Linda Jones, may she rest in peace, Curtis Mayfield, Temptations, Supremes. I mean, yeah, I mean, everybody.
You saw Linda Jones before?
Tyrone Davis. Tyrone Davis, Turn Back the Hands of Time. I mean, we grew up with all that music lineage, you know, and the Apollo Theater was magic, man. Whew, it was like magic. So that's how we started, you know, like that.
Can you, all right, so I always wanted to ask anyone that's ever participated in Amateur Night when they come on the show, and I always forget to ask them, pre-showtime at the Apollo, what is the actual ritual for getting on and then doing Amateur Night? Like, do you have to have chord charts? Do you bring a cassette to whoever the MD is? Or do you just say, we're doing My Girl in, you know, in E minor, and they automatically know it? Like, what's the process of Amateur Night?
Well, yeah, we had a guy with us named George McKinnon, so he knew a lot of the people back there. And the way we got through, we never auditioned or nothing. He would like pay somebody under the table and bam, we would be on the Amateur Night. And in order to get there, the band, we would rehearse, the band would rehearse with people. And if they knew the song, which they always knew, most of them, they knew the song, they would just get the key. Or sometimes, yeah, people would bring in their music. They practice for sheet music. Okay, we got it. Sometimes the band didn't know the song. All right, you got to come up with another one. What do you got, another song you know? And then they would know it. You know what I mean? So that would be the thing. And we'd all be practicing and just getting everything together. And it was crazy. They used to have all the amateurs would be downstairs in the basement. And you could hear, like, the professional show, like Stevie Wonder stomping on the ground. And you could, on the stage, and you could hear him from in the ceiling, like, wow, Stevie Wonder, like, stomping right now, singing Superstition or whatever, you know, Mitchell Match. Yeah. So we would, that's how we would get it with the band members. And they knew Cloud Nine. We didn't have to give them chord. They just had to get it in our right key. And we was able to do it with the Apollo band. Yeah.
Okay. I always wanted to know, like, if someone threw a curveball, like, I want to do Dionne Warwick's Do You Know the Way to San Jose? And the band would say, like, nah, we don't know that shit. That's why I asked, like, did you have to... That explains why everyone did, like, Luther Vandross's If Only for One Night, or...
Yeah.
Or...
Yeah.
All the open mic selection.
Right, exactly. I get it now. So, just leading into your actual recorded career, the first time I heard of you guys was on Curtis Blow's Party Time, but when was the first side that you actually cut? Like the first time that you guys were in the studio recording stuff?
The first thing that we ever cut? Well, we did songs. The first studio thing we ever did was a song called Turn You On. And it was on a small little independent label in Brooklyn. It was on Daz Records. And we thought we made it only because on Daz Records in the Brooklyn was a big hit record called Super Rhyme Rap by Jimmy Spicer.
Yeah, Jimmy Spicer, super rapping, yeah.
Right, may he rest in peace. And we're like, wow, we made it. We're on the same label as him. I mean, we didn't have no damn hit with Turn You On, but that was like our first joint recording it. I mean, like, after that, yeah, we worked with Curtis Blow. We did 5 songs on 2 different Curtis Blow's album. And the first one, you know, we did a song called Big Time Hood, and we did a song called Under Fire. And we actually produced those songs, but at that time, we didn't really have much say, so we got the credit of co-writing it. And I got to give it, and the biggest song we did with Curtis was, yeah, Party Time.
Party Time.
Whoa, it's party time. That song, he brought us on tour with him, and we still weren't known, but he took us on tour, and we did a tour with him, New Edition, Midnight Star, Rick James, and Mary Jane Girls. And I'll never forget.
Oh, wow.
Listen, there's a crazy story. Kurt, if he hears this story, this is going to be my first time saying it, because I want to give you the juice quest.
I think I know where this is going, because Curtis told us a story about Party Time. But go ahead, you tell me the story.
Did he do on the show? On the show? Well, anyway.
He told us a story about doing it in D.C. Yeah. Or
Yes. Because that's the Go-Go joint. That's the Go-Go joint?
Yes, yes.
Oh, yeah. He did. But he just talked about performing it. It probably ain't the same story.
Right. But go ahead.
Oh, man. I hope I don't. Oh, I don't want to get mad.
Say it. Anyway, say it, man.
But here's the deal. So, of course, we did the song Basketball. We co-wrote that, actually, and played on that with him.
What?
But part of the time, when we went on the road, oh, Lord. When we went on the road, Kurt, this was the same time New Edition was starting to get really popular. And they just came out with their first album. And they was the opening act. Then after them, Curtis, then Midnight Star, Mary Jane Girls, Rick James. And this particular night, man, the promoter said, all right, Curtis, you're going to open up this night. And he was pissed. Now, they talked about this some kind of way in the New Edition miniseries. Oh, man, Kurt, don't get mad. Because Curtis, you know, this was back then. So
yes, what, back then.
So upset. And remember, we're unknown, but and we're cool. But he's pissed off. So he's so pissed off. He's pissed off at New Edition. Even though it wasn't New Edition's idea for him to
open up. Yeah, it wasn't their call.
Right.
Right. And he did not, he was still, he said, man, they should have some damn respect. They don't have no respect for me. And blah, 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 blah. He was pissed. Now, so then he said to us, the band, oh Lord. He said, okay, this is what we're going to do, man. We're going to open up. When we walk out of this dressing room, we're going to walk right past their dressing room. And we're going to say it soon as we leave here. I want all of us to say, punk motherfuckers from Boston. And it was like a chant. And he said, y'all with me? And in my mind, I'm like, but I like New Edition. we kind of like them, but oh well. And we all said it as we left the dressing room. We were just all saying it like a chant, going past their damn dressing room right up until the stage. And then he quieted us down from saying it. And I remember it like it was yesterday, you know. It was crazy. But that was back then. Kurt's a whole different guy now.
Of
but
course he is. Of course he is.
We followed suit. We did what we had to do. And that was it.
Mm-hmm. And was there ever a Full Force New Edition? New Edition, Full Force collaboration?
No. Nope.
Well, on the basketball court, basically. We used to play a lot of games against them. And then after they got tired of beating us, they said to us, yo, man, since you can't beat us, we might as well join y'all. And then they became part of our celebrity basketball team that played.
Oh, wow.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. We played against Arsenio Hall, Denzel Washington, and it was Mike Bivens and Ronnie DeVoe that played with us.
Oh, they was the players. Yeah, I know Mike can play.
Ronnie Knight played with us. He could ball his ass off. Dondre Whitfield, Ecstasy from Houdini, may he rest in peace. Grandmaster D, man, those were our teammates, man. And it was crazy, you know, the games we used to have against so many different people. The Full Force All-Stars, we called ourselves.
Hey, on those Curtis Blow records, did you guys ever have any interaction or work with Larry Smith at all?
Yes. The legendary Larry Smith. Yeah, what was man.
It's hard for me to get
it's hard tracking him down.
Him.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, of course, he's not here
info
now.
On him.
But
people that work with him direct. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell us about like just him in general and like his work?
Yeah. Well, Larry, man, he was a genius. You know, he played the guitar, of course, but he was just a genius songwriter. And in the studio, he was just really a workaholic and he always wanted stuff to get right. And he was like Russell Simmons, like go-to guy, you know what I mean? A lot of times with Run DMC, with Houdini, you know, with Curtis Blow, Larry was like a staple. And he knew his music, you know what I mean? And if anybody says, no, Larry's not like that. No, it is like that. It is like that. It's always Larry's way. No matter what. And he didn't want to hear nothing. So that's the respect he built up. So if anybody's like, I don't know if Larry's doing it right. They don't say it to him. They say it to themselves or amongst other people. And I'm like, you think Larry's right with that? No. No. Why'd I say no? This is it. I'm telling you. Hilarious.
That sounds like working with Questlove. Okay, I get it. Okay. Another question I've been dying to ask you. you all right, you just gotta come out and tell me the truth. Now I'm skipping to UTFO. Were those cuts on Leader of the Pack and especially the fade out on Roxanne Roxanne, were those real cuts from Dr. Ice or from Mixmaster Ice? Or those did you real- guys just sample? Come on now, it's too perfect and too executed. Or did you sample those sounds? Because it's too perfect.
Those are cuts. Those are Mixmaster Ice. No, for real. Seriously. I wish my brother B-Fine was here, because B-Fine is the one that orchestrated all of that and with Mixmaster. And he always told Mixmaster, because he was definitely the first DJ in hip-hop. I don't know who else came before him that would play like a musical instrument when he scratched.
Right,
you know,
right.
On a lot of songs. No DJs was doing that. But mm-hmm. being that B was a musician, he was a drummer as well, he orchestrated over and he arranged what Mixmaster would do, you know, and Mixmaster cutting up and scratching on many of those songs, which a lot of DJs didn't do at the time at all.
Another thing that you guys should be credited for was really the first time that we heard an actual authentic breakbeat on record. I mean, before then, drum machines would often, or a live drummer, if you were in the Sugar Hill Enjoy era, was often the music background. But, you know, the first time that I heard what we coined the term a breakbeat was using Billy Squire's big beat for the Educated Rappers verse on Roxanne Roxanne. Can you just explain first of all, even before we get to that, who taught you guys, or who do you credit as your teachers for learning how to craft songs and produce songs? Or was it just trial and error all the time before, and then UTFO is where you perfected it?
Yeah, I would definitely say UTFO is where we perfected it. It was trial and error on some of the things, but once we started producing UTFO, and I got to give like really shout out to my brother B-Fine, Kurt, Baby Jerry, the musicians of the group, and even Shy Shy, but they were the brainstorms with actually putting together the musical stuff. And you're right, Quest, and thanks for that, because a lot of times we don't get that credit. I mean, I'm a modest brother, but I love to get credit where credit is due, and sometimes it's not due to us. But yeah, that was like one of the first samples.
The first time that you heard a breakbeat, yeah.
Exactly, like ever in a record. And then after we did it on Roxanne, we did it on our own song, Unselfish Lover, which was the first time a breakbeat was used in a record, a song, you know what
right.
I mean?
And it was precursor to New Jack Swing, right. Precursor.
Exactly. So and so that was trial and error. And plus we were, you know, we had the soul of hip hop anyway, growing up in Brooklyn and performing it in Harlem and in the Bronx. We were a local group and we always wanted to fuse the hip hop and R&B together. And sampling the Billy Squire thing, nobody's ever done that before. You've heard the big beat on many parties and hip hop parties and stuff like that, but never on record, you know. And that was a big thing. And plus the fact that the late great Educated Rapper had the illest rap on that whole UTFO, Roxanne, Roxanne.
I've memorized that shit and performed it like it was mine in the ninth grade. The reason why I asked that question is because mostly the stories that I hear from any luminary in the 80s when it comes to production, with the exception of Marley Marl, most of the stories I hear is that, you know, most hip-hop production is a rush job. And, you know, maybe a rare example, like Public Enemy would do pre-production in a studio where they have time to be creative and time to think of new sounds and whatnot. But 9 times out of 10, you're going to a studio. You got like 2 to 3 hours to figure out what you're going to do. And then it's a rush job and you're out of there. But that song's pretty, I mean, your production, no matter how sparse it was fairly intricate. So I would figure that it would take more than just 2 to 3 hours to slap something together. So like,
yes.
What was the production process like as far as you guys coming up with ideas? And, you know, you guys infuse like humor and skits and all these things that I figure would take at least 5 to 7 hours to sort of come up with. But in that time period, did you guys have the time in the studio to do those things or?
Yeah. Well, when we was in the studio, we would do a lot of like, you know, like you'd call it like if you're acting, you do dress rehearsal or you would do rehearsing. Mm-hmm. We would go in the studio and not necessarily make the final recording of the joint. We would do all of our ideas then, come up with the ideas. And then after we finish, okay, y'all, we'll be back here tomorrow to finish it off. So it was never a rush thing with us. We definitely took our time with all the songs and the intricacies of it. And we'd plan, and sometimes we'd get the ideas right then and there amongst ourselves. But a lot of times things could be pre-planned as well, but by getting them in the studio first and foremost.
Okay, now, what should also be noted, and I think a person had to have been alive at the time, so I will say that probably one of the very first instances of what we'll say is pre-viral culture. Now, of course, you know, when something's done, it can go viral instantly and spread in milliseconds. But to be alive at the time when Roxanne was out.
The Roxanne Wars.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for talking about this. I was waiting for this because, yes. All right. Come on. Yeah, I was alive. Just, okay.
Like, it was just one of the... It was, well, yeah, exactly. Like, you were 16 at the time this came out.
I just couldn't remember. I was like, who is the real Roxanne? I don't know. It's too confusing.
Well, one I want to know is who was the conceptualizer of Roxanne? How did you get paired with UTFO? And how much control did you guys have over the entire Roxanne
universe
phenomenon? Because there were at least 9 to 11 answer records of various Roxanne's doctor, Roxanne's gynecologist,
Roxanne's a man.
Yeah. I bet you would be. Oh, Roxanne's all their fault.
Yeah, so tell me.
Nah, it was a Roxanne's a man. Roxanne's a man record. Yeah.
There was every sort of record.
Well, there was no Roxanne's a gynecologist quest.
Well, there was a lot.
But you're right. You are right, my brother. There was actually 25, over 25 answer back records to that song. So
yeah, it started the first disc craze.
Yeah, exactly. So what happened was with UTFO, well, in the beginning, my what happened is that how they formed first is that there's four members in UTFO, of course, Dr. Ice, Kangol Kid, the educator rapper, may he rest in peace, and Mixmaster Ice, the DJ. So what happened is that my brother B was going to a junior high school because he was in high school, and he was going there because somebody was messing around with his girlfriend at the time. Somebody was like bothering her and teasing her and everything, and it was Kangol Kid. Okay, so Mike Hughes of Cult Jam knew Kangol Kid. And she kept complaining to my brother B, "Fun, you, this guy keep bothering me, keep picking at me, bothering me." He said, "Okay, I'm going up to school. I'm going to fuck him up. I'm just going up to your school. I'm just going to bust his ass." I said, "Okay." So he talked to Mike Hughes of Cult Jam, because this is before Mike became a Cult Jam. And Mike said, "Yeah, I know Kango, whose real name is Sean Fuqua. So I know him. So yeah, I want you to take me to him now. I want to see him." Okay. Took him to the school. And he was going there to literally kick Kango, get in Kango's face and bust his ass for messing with his girl. So what happened is that Mike said, "Oh, he's right there." So he pointed to Kango, and Kango was on stage during a talent show in the auditorium. And he was dancing. He was pop locking and killing it. And my brother B was looking like in amazement. Wow. So then,
I'm about to fuck that nigga up. No.
Exactly. So he goes to Mike. "All right, Mike, man, I'm going to go, man. I kind of seen enough. Just tell him, first of all, that I came to bust his ass, but he's dancing real good. So I want to talk to him. So you get his number, give him my number, and we'll connect. All right." And then my brother B just left. He left. And Mike Hughes told Kango when he was finishing everything, and Kango came back. He said, "Yo, man, did you see the guy that was next to me? You know, that was standing to me? Yeah, yeah, it's a big nigga, man. Yeah, I saw him. Yeah, man, he came here to kick your ass. That's the renter's boyfriend. And he came here to bust your ass." He said, "Word? Yeah, word. But you danced real good, so he wants to have a meeting. He wants to have a meeting with you." And that's what happened. We met with Kango. Kango brought in Dr. Ice. They danced for us because we used to do local shows, and they did. They were like the first ones to do all the pop and lock. Because remember when the hip hop started, and they used to always have dancers on the stage with them. All the rappers would have dancers. Mm-hmm. Kango Kid and Dr. Ice was the first dancers to dance for a rap group, which was Houdini.
Right.
And they were the first ones. But they started with us dancing on our shows, and we would bring them on, and here they are. And we was impressed with them. And then B said, and then Kango said, "Yo, B, you know, we could rap also." He said, "Y'all could rap?" I said, "Yeah." They got educated rapper, and they formed the rap trio. They came, they kind of auditioned for B. B says, "Yo, man, y'all are dope." And then they got Mixmaster Ice and made them a group. And then Steve Salem, may he rest in peace, Steve Salem, who went to college with me, he was our co-manager. He's the one that took us and the group to Select Records, who was never a hip-hop label at the time. They just was a regular label. And we went there to record records. Because if it wasn't for Steve Salem, we would never be writers and producers. We was only mm-hmm. looking for a deal for Full Force as the performers. I didn't give a shit about writing and producing for other people. I just didn't. And I'm glad I was voted out. But Steve Salem said, "Listen, if you guys..." Because we was getting our demos turned down left and right anyway. He said, "I think if you guys write and produce for other people, I think then Full Force would get a deal of its own." This was his gut. And he was right, because the first production was UTFO, then Lisa Lisa and Cult Jam, Real Roxanne, and then we got our deal. But the Roxanne, they became... And here's the thing. We had a song called Hanging Out. That's supposed to be the A-side.
Right.
The single. But my brother B just woke up and he said, "Yo, man, I came up with an idea, a concept, and let's just put it on the B side." It was like a throwaway idea. He's the one that said,
"I want to
call Roxanne." Roxanne, he just picked the name because he liked the name. He said it worked for the police. He went to UTFO and he said, "Yo, we're going to do a B side. We're going to call it Roxanne. Here's the concept. I want you guys going to be fighting over a girl. And none of y'all would get the girl." Because, you know, back in those times, you know, all the rappers got the girl. But my brother said, "It's going to be nobody gets the girl. And each of y'all come up with your own rap." What was so dope about the song is that B also came up with the concept, which was never done on record before. Each rapper had their own separate beat.
Right.
So the rapper had Big Beat and Kango had his own beat.
Right.
And Doc had his own beat that Full Force created, of course, except for the Big Beat. Actually, Kango might have created his own beat as well, but that's how that record was formed. And it was just a throwaway record to be on the B side. And what happened is that even though we was promoting Hanging Out, all of a sudden here comes this DJ from New York City playing the wrong side, which we thought at the time, and it was DJ Red Alert playing Roxanne, and we were pissed. Could you believe that we got upset in the beginning? And we called Red at his house. And we're like, "Yo, Red." And we woke him up. "Yeah, what?" "Yo, you're playing the wrong side. Don't play that. You got to play the A side. The A side is Hanging Out." He said, "Yo, man, I like the B side." "I know, but that's not the A side." "Well, it should be
it is now.
I'm playing the B side."
And the radio DJ was born. Thank you, Red.
I'm playing the B side. And he stuck to that. The radio station let him do it. And let me tell you something, that song caught on like wildfire. Before all the Answer Back records, that song was just huge. It was big. It was in top 10 Billboard magazine and the R&B charts,
yeah,
as well as one on the rap charts. So we were blown away. And then after the success and was doing great, along comes this 14, 13-year-old brat.
Oh.
Doing Roxanne's Revenge.
So she was after. See, that's why I was always confused. Okay.
That's why they called it Roxanne's Revenge.
Revenge. Duh. Gotcha. All right.
I
was five, Lou. Okay. I'm just putting it in perspective.
Nah, there was a one to the left of that five. You were 15. Anyway.
I remember.
The magic of Roxanne, you're right, the magic of Roxanne was also, I remember, it was the first self-deprecating song, so, you know, it showed, it kind of put hip hop in a everyman position. Like, oh, that could happen to me. That always happens to me. I get rejected by a girl, right?
And Quest.
You know what? It's hit me right now. When Rick Rubin was on our episode, I gave him credit for sort of helming the song format in hip hop, but it just hit me that UTFO's album predated LL's Radio, which it was unheard of at the time for a hip hop song to be under 5 minutes because, you know, in the era of Sugar Hill and Club Records and there not being a lot of hip hop records, you would make them as long as possible so that you can keep the party going. But I mean, at the time, did you guys think that you were doing something revolutionary by making these, you know, 16 bar, maybe 24 bar verses with a chorus and a second verse and a third verse, which was absolutely unheard of then? Like, even a radio song like The Message, and it's like that by Run DMC, was like 7 minutes and 50 seconds. But
damn,
these songs were one of the very first single length hits. Like, was that a conscious decision?
Yeah, that was a conscious decision because, you know, we always involved ourselves in it. So, like, if you have a Roxanne song, we would do the full force harmonies. Roxanne. We always wanted to throw singing in a lot of the records. And we always made it, like you said, not to be so super long, because nothing was wrong with the super long songs like The Message and everything like that. But we was consciously making it so it could be, you know, digestible, especially because we loved hearing the song on regular commercial radio as well. Because the hip hop stations played anything, even if it was 10 minutes. But we was conscious of that for all the different songs, especially that first album, you know. And Kango Kid we call him like a disciple of ours so much because he loved the production and stuff. He came up with the idea to do Fairy Tale Lover, which was the first time a rap group sang
before, yeah,
we did the backgrounds and the music, but Kango sang, Doc sang, even Educated Rappers sang on there, Mixed Master sang, but they did. And they used to perform that song on tour and the place would go crazy because they went on tour with New Edition.
That shit was big.
Yeah.
That shit was bigger than Is This the End. Like, that shit was super big. Wait, it just hit me, there's a lot of firsts in your career, and it just hit me that you guys were also one of the first production teams to self-promote, if you will. People often credit it to Puffy to self-promote, but, you know, the tag Full Force Get Busy one time, like that, that could have been the very first hashtag. Whose idea was it to always promote? You guys were always spicing up all of your productions with your production tag, like your own commercial. Whose idea was that?
Man, I would have to say that was all of our ideas. I mean, and you're right, Quest. Thanks a lot, man. I mean, wow. You're right. We did that on our own because we knew, like, back in the day, a lot of producers, you know, before us, I would say Terry and Jimmy, they started getting notoriety. They had their own style to just the address, but we said, you know, we want to make sure the producers get props in these songs, like us. So we would be like Alfred Hitchcock on a lot of our own productions. You know, Alfred Hitchcock used
sneaking
to make
in his own movies.
Yeah, sneaking in
movies and stuff. So he unassuming, did. But we'd make ourselves assuming, you know. And we would give those tags. Like Full Force Get Busy One Time was the idea of Paul Anthony. First time anybody said get busy. And I'll never forget, we went to a New Edition, not New Edition, New Kids on the Block concert. They were such big fans of ours. And we was like on the backstage, and we was like on the side stage because Marie Starr came and put us on the side. And then the New Kids on the Block kept looking us to the side. And then Donnie Wahlberg, I'll never forget this, he just stopped after their last song. And he said, you know, I just want to make mention here. There's a bunch of guys that's here right now that we look up to because in Boston, the biggest Full Force record at the time was Unselfish Lover that we did.
Right.
And he said to the crowd, all those white girls and white boys there, he said to them, there's some guys in this business now. Y'all might hear Arsenio Hall say, let's get busy. But let me tell you who coined that phrase.
Wow.
Exactly.
He said this. He said, it's a bunch of guys. They go by the name of Full Force. And we got some of the members here right now. And I want y'all to give a big rousing. No, he said, I want you guys to repeat after me and say this loud. I want y'all to say, full force, get busy one time. And I'm going to bring them out. Y'all ready? Here we go. And they said it loud. All these white kids. Full force, get busy one time. And it was crazy. And here we are walking on stage. They never knew us from, and they're clapping and screaming for us. And Donnie's hugging us. That was our first time meeting new kids.
Wow.
Hugging us. And he said, these are the guys, the coined phrase. These guys are popular producers. And he was basically doing like a bio, giving us flowers there.
Wow.
On that stage. And then he said, okay, now we're gonna close it out. Y'all remember the song? Y'all know the hook? Y'all remember the hook? And then we all on stage doing that, singing the hook with New Kids on the Block, because they were fans of ours with the whole self-promotion. And you're right. We said, full force, get busy one time. On the song Unfaithful, don't even try it. Full force, don't buy it.
Right.
On a lot of our records, like on Temporary Love Thing, before it opened, I go, as sure as my name is Bowlegged Lou, I'm blah, 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 blah. And we would do the B-sides, Quest. Like, we used to do skits on the B-side.
Yes.
We were doing skits before De La Soul.
And I
majored in theater, but I would have my fun on the B-side. So we would do a song like Unselfish Lover, and on the B-side, we'd go, it's okay. It's okay. It was like a whole skit.
I got it.
And we said our names and everything. And just to let you know that we wanted to make sure we got our credit as producers as well. When we did the first Lisa Lisa song, I Wonder If I Take You Home, we made a conscious decision. I said, listen, guys, we're singing on this. We're doing the background vocals. We're doing the music. So just for the first album and the first single, it's not going to be Lisa Lisa and Coat Jam. No. It's going to be Lisa and Coat Jam with
Full Force.
I have a question to ask you.
Okay.
I have a question. Okay. The whole world of Questlove Supremes knows that I am the authority on everything Soul Train. So I have this question to ask you. The very first time you guys, well, first of all, I would assume that in 85, appearing on Soul Train would have been like a major bucket list moment. And based on the relationship that you and the camaraderie that you guys had with Don Cornelius on the show, that meant something to you. But I always wanted to know, the very first time that you guys appeared on Soul Train, you guys were never announced by Sid McCoy on the top of the show. You kind of just came in as special guests. This is when you guys did, Alice. You did Alice the first time. And you weren't credited. Were you guys ever disappointed? Do you know what I mean by announced? You know, at the top of the show when Sid McCoy announces Soul Train, the hippest trip in America with guest stars, Full Force, and the Soul Train dancers. I always wondered why they never had you guys at the top of the show. Like, you guys were just announced as a matter of fact. But I always wanted to know, were you guys even aware of that? Or...
Well, I wasn't aware, but the first time we performed as Full Force, the group by ourselves, we did Unselfish Lover.
And then you did Alice during the interview.
Exactly.
That was one of my favorite moments ever. Yeah.
Yeah, because Don tried to stop us after a while, but then we ended it, and he goes, because he kept saying, all right, hold on.
Right.
Ended it, and everybody was cool with that. But before that, and I think they announced us at the top of the show for that particular show. But before Unselfish Lover, the Full Force by Full Force, the first time we appeared on there was with Lisa Lisa, me and Paul. And we performed All Cried Out.
Yeah. Right.
And that was the very first time we was on Soul Train. I don't think we were announced then. I think it was just Don said,
even then you weren't announced at the top. Right.
Just Lisa Lisa, not even Coat Jam.
Right. I was gonna say you're the only artist I know whose first two appearances on Soul Train were never announced by Sid McCoy. I consider it an honor, at least if I were making music at the time, that if Sid McCoy says your name with his golden voice, that's sort of like, that's the thumbs up thing. And you guys didn't get that moment until your third time on the show when you guys were promoting Guess Who's Coming to the Crib and love is for suckers and all that. But
I just want to go back because you mentioned this real fast, but I'm trying to figure out how you had the time, because you said you met Steve in college and you were a theater major. When, what school, and can you just talk about like being a theater major and what that did for the craft?
Yeah, I went to Kingsborough Community College for 2 years, Brooklyn College for the other 2 years, and I majored in theater because there's a teacher of mine in high school named Miss McKinley. She like really inspired me to do acting. And I was like, I was always crazy and still crazy to this day. And I always loved the acting. And when I majored in theater, it was a big deal because it was a predominantly white school. And they were so serious with all their productions. And I was in every one of their productions, even plays that I hated, like Medea and Shakespeare, yuck. But I still wanted to be on stage and audition for every play. And that's what I did. And I brought that. And before that, I used to do little plays with my brothers in our home. And the audience used to be family members, like my mother and father. We do little plays that I would write, just bullshit plays, nothing big. And then we do this and do that. And my brothers hated it, but they still did it. And we were young. And that's where our chemistry grew, the three of us, to have the chemistry to go on and pursue what we were doing, you know. But, Quest, I want to go back to what you said about Don Cornelius. Yeah. I know that you are such a soul train aficionado and educator. Yes. And I heard you was going to do something on Broadway. Please put me down, even if I'm the usher in there. I don't care. Because when I tell you I love with my heart Don Cornelius as a man, as a person, and I just love him. And I'll never forget how, you know, I had his home number, his cell. And I was like, wow, Don Cornelius. And then meeting him for the first time. And then we developed a chemistry that you could even see whenever we would come there. He would, like any groups that we managed, like Cheryl Pepsi Riley or the girl group Ex-Girlfriend, he would always want to announce us to come on stage to like sort of take a bow or something like that after he finished interviewing them. Or sometimes I'll call him on his birthday, like I call people on their birthdays forever. But
you do.
I call people on their birthday just to say happy birthday. This is way before Facebook and social media. I got my old school calendar, people's birthdays, and I call them up. And Don Cornelius, I always used to do that through the ups and the downs with people. I don't care where they are in their career, whatever. I just always like to reach out. And with Don Cornelius, man, it was just such a great thing to do. I'm able to get my girlfriend at the time. She was doing a project on Soul Train, and I got her to interview Don on the phone just for her. And he did that for me, you know.
He did your Unsung. That's rare too.
Yeah, along with Questlove, who before meeting Quest, we just met, like he said, through the social media thing, and I reached out to him and asked, would he be a part of our Unsung, man? And Quest, I'll never forget how you said, oh, hell yeah, man. And you was just so great on the show. You gave us great props. And I'll never forget that, man. Don Cornelius never did Unsung ever. And keep in mind, when people did that show, a lot of their film, a lot of their clips from their performances used to be them performing on Soul Train. The OJs, George Clinton, Parliament, Funkadelic. Mm. And they always wanted to get him, but he never, never did it.
Wow. Right.
I said, I would love to get Don Cornelius. They said, oh, he doesn't need to do it. We ask him all the time. He always says, no, he doesn't care. I said, well, let me ask him. Well, we're not going to give you his number. I said, no, I got his number. let me see if he'd do it for us.
Right.
And I called him up and he said, all right, they've been asking me so many times, man. But, you know, if I got to do it for somebody, I owe them. If I got to do it for somebody, Lou, I'm going to do it for you, man. I'm going to do it for full force. And that was his last televised
anything
on on TV before he passed. And I have all the other footage because he was on much longer than what they edited, like maybe 2 or 3 bites. But I have the whole footage of him talking about us. And he was supposed to come to the screening of that Unsung episode in L.A. He got tickets, but he was going to be at a table. And he didn't come for some reason. And then 2 days later.
Wow.
No, really?
Damn.
Blew me away. I was crying, man, like a baby. I was on the phone with Lee Bailey doing an interview with him, crying like a baby, man, with Don Cornelius. And we presented a plaque for Don Cornelius, even though he wasn't there, because we didn't know why he lived, but we did a special dedication plaque for him there. I said, Don is not here, but we want to do a special tribute for him. And I ended up giving the plaque to a Tony at Don's funeral. Great man. Don, Soul Train. What a come on, Quest. You know.
Soul Train. I know.
They have a term now. What's the proper term, Amir? So that Lou knows you are a soul trainophile. What's it called? A soul trainophile.
Trainophile. That doesn't sound right. Yeah, soul train. Anyway. I'll say that probably the other artist I've been dying to interview on the show, just so I can ask her this question, is probably the artist that you've had the best success with. Did Lisa ever tell you what her first thoughts were when she auditioned for you guys?
Yeah, she was afraid.
I was going to say, what was the whole situation of you guys discovering Lisa and her coming to audition for you? How did you discover?
Yeah, well, my brother B-Fine, he came up with the song, I Wonder If I Take You Home. You know, he wrote the lyrics. I mean, we added the little extra stuff with the arrangements and the vocals and stuff. But B came up with the concept. He wrote the lyrics out. Kurt, Jerry, they all pitched in musically and everything like that. But it was B's baby. And now B, when he did that song, and he did the reference vocal to it, which was horrible, but he did it anyway.
You still got the demo?
I think so. Why it was so horrible. But with that song, it was so catchy. And this was like right after literally Roxanne started doing what it's doing. We was already crafting that. So B wanted, no matter what, he wanted a Hispanic girl to sing that song. No black girl, just Hispanic. I wanted a black girl to do it because Cheryl Pepsi Riley at the time was my dear friend and I was in love with her voice. So I let her hear the demo with B's bad singing on it. I said, listen, B wants a Spanish girl to do this, but I want you to do it. I want to sneak you in the studio and have you sing it and then surprise B. But she didn't like the song. She said she was loyal to a group at the time, but I remember playing it for her and her husband. And I don't think they liked it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Anyway, B wouldn't have heard it anyway. B wouldn't have cared. He wanted a Spanish girl to do it. So Mike Hughes, we was auditioning girls. So Mike Hughes from Code Jam, he's the one that brought Lisa to us because they used to Lisa at the Funhouse club in Manhattan where Madonna used to go to all the time. Lisa would be there partying. And Lisa was young at the time, but Mike would see her there. I think she was 17 or something like that. And he brought her to our basement in Brooklyn so we could hear if she could sing. We loved her look. Automatically, as soon as we saw her, we went, wow, I hope she could sing even a little bit.
Y'all barely saw her face.
Her face.
She has a face?
And everything else, you know what I mean? And she was Hispanic. So at that time, there was no Spanish, there was no Puerto Ricans or Spanish girls doing anything in resembling dance, R&B, and hip-hop combo.
This is before
one.
Gloria, right? That's what I didn't realize. This is before Gloria.
This is before Shakira. This was before J-Lo. This was before Ricky Martin, before any Spanish person.
Can I ask, was what we know as freestyle?
Freestyle, yeah.
Was that on you guys' mind at the time? Because, I mean, the only person I could tell that was like even trying to touch that was maybe Jellybean Benitez.
Yeah,
maybe
Lizette Melendez.
I mean, Shannon was sort of going there, but freestyle wasn't a defined genre. But were you guys trying to figure out how to corner that market? Or did you know that if you found someone of that level, it could be big for the Latinx market?
Well, you know something? That wasn't even B's reasoning. I didn't even hear the word freestyle until after we did Lisa. I mean, Shannon kind of did let the music play, and B disclosed to me actually today that him, Kurt, and Jerry used to be in the basement, and they loved the sounds of John Roby and what's John Roby's other partner that was
Arthur Baker.
Arthur Baker, they love those type of records, and they would try to emulate those type of records. You know,
like No Frills.
Emulate those type of records. Okay. Yeah, so Shannon, Well, I think they let the music play. It wasn't called freestyle when she did it. And I'm thinking because she was black. Because it wasn't until we did Lisa Lisa, then other Spanish and Hispanic started popping out of nowhere. And that's where they coined the frame freestyle.
So what makes something freestyle, y'all? I'm sorry. Act like I'm in elementary school. What classifies?
You know the sound of Stevie B? Like, imagine the sound of, like, Planet Rock.
But like not as fast, not quite as fast. But
it would be like New Jack Swing, like adding adding sung vocals to a track that is breakdanceable.
Okay,
okay.
Mm-hmm. Let the music play.
No, let the music play is definitely it falls in that lane. Okay. What's another one?
Let the music play kind of falls in that way. Yes, yes. We got
like the props, sound, the sound of Mantronix, the sound of the Latin Rascals,
yes.
The sound of
But Hispanics wasn't doing it. They weren't doing it at that time. You know, they weren't just doing it at the time. But when we brought out Lisa with Can You Feel the Beat and Can You Feel the Beat, especially the Take You Home, everybody started calling it freestyle. And then you had people like Exposé and all of them popping up out of nowhere. And they called it freestyle because of the Spanish market, because of the Spanish artists. That's what they called freestyle. We started it off with Lisa. And B, and when Lisa came to audition to sing, she started singing songs that Mike Hughes from Coach Jam wrote. So she was singing an acapella and they were horrible. You know, Mike Hughes would write that she was singing songs like to dance and to love, to dance and to love. And we're like, oh my God, this is horrible. And it made her sound kind of shitty because of his songs. So before she left, because we're like, oh man, I don't think this is going to work. Before she left, because we loved her look so much, Paul said, listen, Lisa, before you leave, can you sing us something that's more familiar? Because all she was singing was Mike Hughes' original corny songs.
Right.
You fucking with him.
He knows that. So Lisa sang for us For Your Eyes Only by Sheena Easton.
Holy shit.
That's right.
Why do I know that song?
Yeah.
And that's all she wrote. And we did I Wonder If I Take You Home with Lisa. And B was always to the fact that he didn't want Lisa to sound, he didn't want whoever was going to sing it, he didn't want like a Patti LaBelle or a Grace.
That's why Cheryl wouldn't have worked.
Yeah. Just somebody. She was too polished.
Just other young girls, especially Hispanic girls, where they could sing along.
They could sing along.
Girl next door. Girl next door. Yeah.
Exactly. Right, and that was the genius of that. And when that song came out, it was crazy because we took it to an independent label who was doing a deal with Columbia Records, Personal Records, which was run by Jurgen Kay and Don Oriolo. And I remember Steve Salem, may he rest in peace, and my brother B-Fine went there. They loved the song, but they wanted another singer. I think Jurgen's wife, her name? I forgot. But they wanted another singer. So B thought about it and Steve, and they said, nah, we'll pass. And I said, really? And we're here ready to give you like a little deal? Then we'll pass. And then they called the very next day. All right, we'll do it with Lisa. And that record appeared on a compilation, which had songs like Buffalo Gal by Malcolm McLaren.
Yeah,
and that was the only new song on there. I Wonder If I Take You Home. And let me tell you, that song took off like wildfire. It blew us away because we were in England working with Samantha Fox. When we came back to New York, they were playing that shit in the clubs. I'm like, wait a minute, where did y'all get this? I'm like, it was ridiculous how that song just took off, you know? And it took off so much from a compilation album that we were rushed to hurry
yeah.
finish the rest of the album, yeah.
Because they had the album cover was ready, but we just didn't finish the damn record. We had to hurry up and do the album, which we did and finished, you know.
But, really?
Yeah.
That's crazy. Wait, there's another question I have. Were you guys ever involved with Little Tony Marsh? Because in Philly, her Video Burnout song was like a heavily played.
What?
Was heavily played like on our station, Power 99. And I know that like she was on that Found Someone For Me sketch. Like she would do sketches with Lisa and whatnot. But did you guys ever produce Little Tony Marsh as well? Or
Wow, she would love to hear you just say that. But
dude, I lost my mind. I saw a post from Lisa on IG, and I happened to look at one of the comments, and it wasn't Toni Marsh, but it was enough to make me, when I clicked and I saw the face, I was like, wait a minute, is this actual Toni Marsh? Like, I didn't see the response if she responded or not, but no, I definitely know who Toni Marsh is.
Little Toni Marsh is now going by the name of Toni Minaj, and that's what she calls herself, Toni Minaj, but she spells it differently, M-E-N-E-G-E. And let me tell you something, she is such a talented singer, performer. She's incredible. She blew me away. I was so surprised. But she's now the personal manager for Lisa.
What?
Yes. Wow. Now.
Damn.
Yeah, because what happens is that Lisa was managed by this other girl, this other woman named Stephanie. May she rest in peace. But Stephanie was sort of she blocked a lot of things. She, for whatever reason, she didn't have much love for Full Force and whatever. Because we used to manage Lisa when Lisa was with us. We parted ways amicably, with all our artists. But Toni Marsh was a background singer for Lisa on first tour. Right. And that's how we knew Toni Marsh. But I remember Video Burnout. I'm like, wow, you did Video Burnout? And she was with Lisa from then, 85, 86, till now. Doing background vocals for Lisa on there and everything like that.
Little Toni Marsh there was a period in which, like,
it's on Apple Music.
And so on Apple Music, that's crazy. See, those are the type of songs where the vocals won't even start until the 5-minute mark.
Oh, okay. Right. How long
is the song? Right. The intro is like 3 minutes. There was a period, especially between like 83 and 85, where like a lot of these weird novelty songs would come up. Like Irene Cara had a song about breakdancing. But Little Toni Marsh's song was notable because it was about her addiction to going to the arcades to playing video games.
That's real. That was real in the 80s, though. That
Hell yeah, man. That was real. You know, yeah. Let my ass come home.
Space Invaders. Late. Yeah.
Yeah, late because I was at the arcade. I get in trouble. Wait, Lou, are you at all aware of the Prince You Got the Look story?
No. Tell me.
All right. I always wanted to know this. So there's a friend of mine who, I guess at the time, like, she was kind of messing with Prince or whatever. And at the time, she was like 18. So this is like 1987. This is when Spanish Fly is out. Or this is right before Spanish Fly, the second Lisa album comes out. And she's in the break room of his studio while he's recording what we will know is Sign of the Times. And, you know, because of the age difference, I mean, he's like, at that time, he was like 27. She's 18. She's more in tune to like younger stuff and really not, you know, not on his level, you know, of where music is. And so Robert Palmer's video for Addicted to Love comes on. And she's like, oh, I really love this song. And Prince is like rolling his eyes like, really? I'm fucking a god here, and this is what impresses you. and so it was really getting under his skin, and he decided to like test her, like, okay, so what do you like about this song? So, well, you know, it has a good beat and da 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 da. And Prince is like, no, you just like it because you just see a bunch of women faking playing instruments, but anybody could do that shit. I could do that shit. And so he stops the song he's working on, totally wipes the board. They're at Sunset Sound in LA. And he says, I'll tell you what, I'm going to create a song, and I bet you that the only reason why you like Addicted to Love is because it's on television and you're just influenced because something's on television. But if something of better quality were in your face, you couldn't even discern the difference. So basically, he created kind of you got the look with a chip on his shoulder. And he completes the song, and it winds up on Sign of the Times. And so he reminds the girl, he's like, all right, my third single is going to be You Got the Look, and I bet you any amount of money, now you're going to like the song because it's going to be a big hit. So, of course, You Got the Look comes out, and it's slowly riding up the charts. And right when Prince is going to get cocky and be like, yeah, next week this shit's going to be number one, Lost in Emotion comes in
wow.
And fucks it up.
Hilarious.
And he was so angry at that shit because he's like, you wrote a number two. You didn't write no number one hit. Lisa, Lisa. And I like that song better. And so it was like,
wow. It
was, I never heard that story. Is that a story he told?
No, her name. Okay, so in you know, Prince has a long line of muses, so kind of the
he's the only one that gets to call him that. I love it.
I know. So kind of the last muse of the first phase of muses, you know, which starts with Patrice Rushen and Vanity and Sheila E. and whatever. Her name was, I think he christened her. Anna Fantastic.
I can't. He christened her.
He
christened what's her name? Carmen Electra. Like
he christened a lot of them.
He gave her her name? I didn't know that.
He names all of his women. He's like, what's your name? Yeah. Nope, that's not your name. This is your name.
Oh, Prince. You motherfucker. You so lucky you ain't living in 2021.
So basically... He lost a bet because Lost in Emotion kind of
but you won, Lou.
Took him
but
out.
You won.
But you beat him. But what I wanted to know was, at least with the songwriting craft, you can definitely hear, especially on that second album, the Motown influence.
Yes.
You know, obviously, back in my heart again and all that stuff. For the second album, what was you guys' mind state in producing like her second album?
Yeah, well, our mindset was to kind of grow. Because, you know, when she came out with Take You Home and Can You Feel the Beat, you know, we didn't want it to be, because the record company, like going back to the first album, the record company did not want to release All Cried Out at all. They just wanted to keep. Yeah, not at all. They just wanted to keep up-tempo songs and just make Lisa just this dance thing. We did All Cried Out, but it's like, no. So we had to fight them on that. And when it was a single, it was, the rest is history. But for the Spanish Fly, we wanted to elevate. And that's when that album was called just Lisa, Lisa and Code Jam. You know, the first album was called Lisa, Lisa and Code Jam with Full Force, but this one was just them. And Paul started it off with Head to Toe with the whole Supremes type vibe. And then B spearheaded the second one, Lost in Emotion. And we added a lot of the old time things and elements to that song, to Lost in Emotion, Head to Toe. And it was a number one record back to back on the pop charts, number one, and on the R&B charts, number one, back to back. It was crazy at that time. And Lisa was so surprised. She was like, damn, they really like this song? I'm talking about Head to Toe.
What y'all didn't know was that y'all were creating music for a new genre of things for kids, which was, let's go on the playground and create choreography and make our own dances based off of these songs. And that's the Head to Toe, I swear to God, that was the first time that across all the playgrounds, choreography.
See, that's weird you said that, Laia, because I was going to say that Head to Toe, and I remember there was a period, like between Head to Toe, you guys' second album with Old Flames Never Die, and even with Lost in Emotion, like I had a coworker at a job I used to work at who was like slightly older. So he was kind of like an uncle. And he was one of them guys that was like, see, man, they ain't nothing but Diana Ross. They ain't nothing but Sly and the Family Stone. So I didn't even understand like what it meant to be derivative or that sort of thing. Or like, so he was like explaining to me like, well, see, this reference is, you know, a Sly reference that they did from this song. And then that's when I started to look for like kind of the anatomy of a song and how it comes from older songs that I never knew that before that moment. And when I realized you guys really won older adults.
Yeah.
Because you were speaking a new language, but
with that formula, right?
You said kids got it and adults got it. So with you guys' own career, I believe it wasn't the executive of Columbia, Rodriguez. What's his name?
Ruben Rodriguez.
Yeah, Ruben. Was he sort of the not the product manager, but was he like the head A&R? Was he the who was at the helm of running things as far as Full Force and Lisa Lisa and Cult Jam?
And Cheryl Pepsi Riley, because we were all in the same label and all part of the Full Force family. Ruben Rodriguez was the head of promotions, radio promotions. Mm-hmm. Cecil Holmes was head of Urban A&R, so was Larkin Arnold.
A&R. Larkin was still there?
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, Larkin Arnold.
Yo, talk, I remember his name from, like, back at Capitol.
Marvin Gaye.
Yeah. Yeah, with Marvin and also doing the Silvers, doing Tavares and all that. What was Larkin Arnold like?
Larkin was very stern. He was just kind of a stern guy. He's very serious, no nonsense. And when we came on there, and it was actually his idea. We didn't like the idea, but a lot of times we always tell people that our first Full Force single was a song called Alice, I Want You Just For Me.
Alice, I Want You Just For Me, yeah.
But,
me.
But it really wasn't. It was actually a song called Girl, If I Take You Home, which was, and only because we had all that answer back stuff with UTFO, because there were so many answer back records to UTFO's Roxanne, Roxanne, that we even jumped on our own bandwagon and we were the ones to come out with the real Roxanne. So that was part of Full Force's camp.
I forgot to ask you. Yeah.
But Larkin wanted us, man, you think maybe I could do an answer back record to I Wonder If I Take You Home? I'm like, are you serious? And he said, yeah, I think it'll work. And we did Girl, If I Take You Home. And we even had Lisa sing a little bit in there. And it didn't really do it that hot. And like, we didn't want to do it. But when we came out with Alice, you know, that was the charm for us. But Larkin Arnold, he was...
Wait, wasn't Girl, If I Take You Home on the B-side of the 12-inch?
It was on the 12-inch, and the other side was a song called Let's Dance Against the Wall. But Girl, If I Take You Home was the first single. Alice was a single by itself with a lot of different Alice dub mixes and stuff like that on the 12-inch.
No, no, no. I was asking about... Because I know on the B-side, there was like a version of I Wonder If I Take You Home on Lisa's 12-inch, in which there might have been a rap. Kind of the way, like, if you remember Cameo's She's Strange, there was a She's Strange rap. But there was a... And the same for Atomic Dog. The B-side of Atomic Dog was Atomic Dog rap. On the B-side of the 12-inch of Lisa Lisa, it was definitely what I assume were you guys' voices doing a quasi-rap thing.
And you're right, it was called Take You Home Rap.
And it was like, so this is not the same song?
No, and that was on the Lisa Lisa album. The Girl If I Take You Home was a whole different thing. And, you know, Larkin Arnold, you know, he was a really no-nonsense kind of dude. And so no-nonsense that he definitely cost us a shot at being on the Crush Groove soundtrack. I mean, the replacement song, of course, was not shabby. Terry Lewis and Jimmy Jam, but Russell Simmons, when they did Crush Groove, because at the time Russell Simmons just came up with Def Jam to be part of Columbia Records, and you had a lot of black executives because Russell did the deal with, you know, the white power of this bees, power of the bees, and a lot of the other black executives were kind of feeling away. So Russell Simmons wanted our song, Unselfish Lover, with the big beat and everything. He wanted that to be the love scene when Blair Underwood and Sheila E. was doing their thing.
Ah, shit. Okay.
Gotcha.
That's what he wanted. He wanted that. And Larkin Arnold was like, no, no, no. It's just going to be for the Full Force album. We was like, can it be in the movie? We were so excited that Russell wanted it. And Larkin Arnold said no. So they ended up getting some, corny song like Tender Love by The Fourth Movie.
But wait a minute. Okay, so you said something, and now I got to get back to the physicality aspect of Full Force. Is there really such a thing as an executive being no nonsense with the six of you guys in the room? They got to have some balls. Now, I don't want to ask any pugilism questions.
Yes, pugilism?
But I do want to know. And it could even be amongst yourselves.
I'm going to look that up while you guys, ask the question.
Have you guys ever had a situation where y'all had to go full Brooklyn on someone in real life, not in the movies?
Okay.
This or did motherfuckers leave y'all alone? Did they leave y'all alone?
Yeah, yeah. Nobody fucked with us. Even though we had our Jerry curls, and even though Paul used to wear a little eyeliner and stuff like that, nobody fucked with us. I'll never forget... Fat Man, was it Fat Man Scoop? Yeah, Fat Man Scoop once told me, he says, yo, man, I'm telling you, growing up, man, y'all had the Jerry curls and all of that stuff and dressing crazy like Prince sometimes, but not even the hardest nigga back in the day would want to fuck with y'all. And everybody just gave us respect because we was on tour. We did the Fresh Fest. We did a lot of Fresh Fest. We were like the only musical act on a lot of different Fresh Fest things. And the only time we went full Brooklyn and didn't come to fighting, but we were kind of threatened sort of, and was with when we was on tour with Larry Blackman and Cameo.
And wow.
Yeah. And what happened is that in our act was a crazy, wild, full force act. And, you know, at the time, there was nobody in music like flexing physical fitness, like nobody. It was just us with our droopy Jerry curls and everything.
Oh, Paul and those shirts, yes.
Oh yeah. Paul
with those shirts and those pants. I think that you have a shot of the pants right behind you in that photo.
Oh yeah, with the microphone.
The pants with your hand on your.
That's like with some, with the hand on the crotch. And
I thought that was a Larry Blackman move. I thought that was a Cameo move, but go ahead.
No, we had that way before Larry's cod piece. I was doing that.
Okay.
The cod piece.
The Temporary Love Thing video, I got one with a microphone on there. But when we would do our shows, Paul, at the end of the show, I would say, ladies, before we go, how many of y'all would love to see Paul Anthony take it off? And they would go crazy. Because we would bring the stripper mentality.
Hell yeah.
We would bring the stripper mentality to the stage. Nobody did that either.
It wasn't
I'll never forget Michael Bivens go, yo, Lou, man, how do you like when people be, you know, 50 Cent, Ella, they take off their shirt? I mean, y'all started that, you know? I said, well, whatever. But I remember when Paul Anthony take it off, Paul would take off his shirt and you know, the women would go crazy. And then after that, I would say, wait a minute, y'all, ladies, wasn't that some cheap shit? They go, yeah. I said, well, shouldn't he? Well, everybody say cheap shit. And then I say, he should finish the job, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I said, ladies, everybody in the house, they pull it down. Pull it down. Pull it down. And man, pull it down. And then Paul would get up and we would do the whole musical thing like a drama show. And the music and Jerry would do the keyboards like Sinister. And
wait, Paul, why just Paul?
Have you seen Paul? Have you seen Paul?
But they're all buff. They're all like Bill.
I know Paul started the ball rolling. After that, I would do some stripping. But let me just tell you about Paul.
Keep it real.
So what Paul would do, he would unbuckle the belt and unbuckle this, and we'd play the music. Then he'd turn around, and he said, man, y'all know I can't do that. He'd turn around, and then he'd get his pants together. He'd turn back, and he pulled on his pants, and there was the G-string, and the place went
crazy. Yeah.
So crazy. And then Paul would start flexing and doing his body build poses, and the women would go so stupid. I got into the act later, and I think I did like maybe 5 times. What I would do when I pulled down my thing, my G-string was electric bulbs all around my shit. And it would be blowing in the dark. We turn off the lights in the whole venue, and you just see my flashing lights on my shit.
See?
But then the first time I did it, I got electrocuted. And I never did it again.
Wait,
yo.
What?
Yo.
Yeah, the bugs electrocuted my nuts. And I never did it ever again. It was crazy.
Thank you, Lou, for your service. I appreciate
that's
it.
That's our clip for the week.
Lou, that is our clip of the week.
That's our clip for the week.
It is.
It was so crazy. Roasted nuts. And you know, it's so crazy with Paul, because it was so ridiculous. I remember Jamie Foxx telling us how he remembered our show, the way we came out.
I bet he did.
We would do stuff like the Alice sandwich. We'd get a girl and bring up on stage. And Paul
pick her up. Yeah.
And Paul would grab her. Then I'd get behind the girl. Then Paul would pick me up and the girl up at the same time. Our show was just
Alice sandwich.
Alice sandwich. That was, I remember that. You know? That was on the Unsung.
And our show would be bananas and wild. So much so that at the end of the show, I'd say, how many of y'all would like to know which hotel we staying at tonight?
Woo!
Then I go, I can't do that, man, because the people at the Marriott down there, 22 Jefferson Street, would be upset.
See, you know what you just proved, Paul? I'm thinking about Paul, Lord. You know what you just proved, Lou? You just proved that 2021 sucks. Like, we could never. Like, that just can't happen. And no male artist is willing to give as much as y'all gave. Thank you.
Wait, you don't think that's happening right now in Atlanta?
Not in the same situation. They have their clothes on. The women are naked. It ain't the men taking their clothes off and doing that. No, men don't do that. They make you take yours off even though you pay for your ticket.
It's still happening. It's just happening in the DMs now.
So check this out. So with that, Larry Blackman's manager or road manager came backstage to us and he said to us, hey, listen, y'all got to stop that strip. Y'all got to stop taking off the clothes stuff. And we're like, why? Yeah, Larry don't want that. Larry don't want none
family
of that
show.
Larry don't want that. This was during the Word Up tour. Uh-huh. We did like 25 dates with him. And I said, so then Paul said, so wait a minute. Larry Blackman said that? Yeah, Larry Blackman said that. I said, well, listen, because we have so much respect for Larry Blackman and Cameo, because they treated us nice. So I said, well, can Larry come back here and tell us that? Can he tell us that he doesn't want us to do the strip no more? Can you please tell him to come back here and let's talk and let's see what he has to say? And then the guy looked at us and said, oh, no, Larry don't talk to the opening act. He don't talk to opening acts.
Wow.
So after that, we looked at him and Paul said, oh, really? Larry don't talk to open act? All right, give this message to Larry. Tell him, fuck him, and that tonight I'm wearing canary yellow G-string. All right? Tell him that. He said, all right. And then we had, like, everybody on the road with us, our roadies, was all from our neighborhood, from our Brooklyn neighborhood. Some of the same guys that used to tell us, man, y'all should get a job, man. Why y'all rehearsing? Y'all should get a job. Well, we took them on the road with us, the summer tours, and we told them to get ready to listen. If anybody tries to fuck with our sound or do one of those sabotage shits, we gonna fuck
them
up.
Down.
Bottom line. Yeah, oh yeah, it's definitely going down, Brooklyn style, without a fucking doubt. But nobody fucked with our shit. Nobody fucked, because we were waiting after we sent that message back. And there was no problem after that. We stayed the same. Sometimes we don't even know if Larry said that. He might not have said that.
Right.
But I remember us telling that story in front of Larry, which he didn't deny, but we told that in front of him when we had a seminar. It was us, Larry Blackman, and Ike Turner.
Holy shit.
Whoa.
Yeah. I don't.
Yeah. Whoa. May he rest in peace. Right. And we told that story. And Larry just laughed, you know. Larry just laughed. So, you know. But that's the closest, though.
Ladies and gentlemen, I know you hate it when this happens, but yes, we are interrupting this powerful Bowlegged Lou episode of Questlove Supreme to let you know that there is a part two coming next week. All right? So make sure you join us for more Full Force stories, more Lisa stories, more Cheryl Pepsi Riley stories, more house party stories, more James Brown stories, more Bowlegged Louisms. All right, we'll see you next week. Questlove Supreme.
Hey, this is Sugar Steve. Make sure you keep up with us on Instagram at QLS and let us know what you think and who should be next to sit down with us. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.